Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, your host of Speaking Broadly. On each episode, I talk to extraordinary people who are behind the scenes in the restaurant industry and bring us tales of their successes and challenges. Today, I'm talking to an extraordinary woman who is the CFO of Tender Greens, which, if you don't know it, it's a fast casual restaurant group based in California that now has 24 locations. And their special sauce, they have chefs cooking in each restaurant, and they're inspired every day by what's at the Green Market. I met this incredible woman, Lena O'Connor, at a conference recently, and I was struck by her intelligence, her candor, her humor, and her drive to success. Welcome, Lena. I'm so excited to have you on Speaking Broadly.
Hi, I'm so excited to speak with you, too. It was so fun to spend some time together last week. I've been talking a lot about you to everyone since then, so it's an honor to be together today.
That's what's so funny. I was like, actually, I want to have you on the pod so that I can talk to you more, because though I got the tip of the iceberg, there's so much more I want to know about how you came to this incredible position of being the chief financial officer of this ever-growing group. As so many things, it seems like your journey began with your family. Your mother sounds completely extraordinary. She worked at Chinois on Main, and she started out as a bookkeeper. And I would just love to hear what that was like when you were a little kid. What was your mom doing, and in what way did that inspire you?
Sure. I mean, yes, she's pretty amazing. She was an immigrant, moved to the United States in 1980, worked for a restaurant supply company where Wolfgang would come in and shop for the original Spago. And, he wasn't famous at the time. No one, she certainly didn't know who he was.
So it was
time to open Chinois in Maine. He said, hey, why don't you come and be the bookkeeper at Chinois? And she hesitated. She had a job. I mean, again, there's no reason to follow somebody else that she didn't really know particularly well, but they had built a relationship, and she took the plunge, and within 5 years, she was the general manager of Chinois in Maine. And, you're talking 1988 at that point. It was the hottest restaurant in town, and she's pretty much a badass. I mean, she's always been an overachiever, and that's always been an inspiration to me. I think she probably works a little too much. That's just, my personal thought, but she's so dedicated to hospitality and to providing that experience to her guests, and that's always inspired me, because I got to run around the restaurant a lot. I mean, when I was 7 years old, I would, they'd let me chop cucumbers in the kitchen. I know that doesn't happen anymore. I hope I don't get in trouble for saying that. I spent a lot of time at the restaurant. When I was a teenager, I would cashier at lunch, and, I remember, going to dinners from time to time at the Spago in Hollywood, before I worked there when I was a teenager, and thinking, God, I want so badly to be part of this industry, so badly to be, friends with all the chefs. It drew me in, and, I wanted so badly to be part of it. And then when I graduated from high school, I went to college in California at Cal State Northridge, and this woman, Heidi White, was the controller at Spago, and she said, hey, we need an assistant controller. It's part-time. Do you want to come work here? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And it was just such an extraordinary experience, because I had, worked as a teenager a little bit, during lunch at Chinois, but just, being part of the original Spago in Hollywood for 5 years, I ended up working there. It's hard to even describe. It just had so much history, and everyone was so passionate. I saw all these great chefs come through there, you know, in my time. And they were about to open the Spago in Beverly Hills. So there was a transitionary period. But
so you know, I have to ask.
Michael Christie was there. Gina DeCue, I remember. Thomas Boyce. I mean, like, everybody worked there. And I got to be part of that. Ari, who still works for them. It was pretty awesome, actually.
That is such an incredible group of chefs. But I'm curious. If it were me, I'm not sure I would want to work where my mother worked. I think I would say, like, I need to separate myself. Did you have any feelings like, oh, man, I can't do what my mom did? That would just be, you know, bad. Who am I?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, after I graduated college, I ended up actually working at Chinois in Maine as assistant general manager for a year and a half. And at that point, I had this big epiphany, like, hey, I need to kind of carve my own path. I need to be my own person. And it's at that point that I applied to go to get my master's at Cornell at the hotel school, because in my mind I said, you know, if I stay here, if I stay on this path, like, I will basically turn into my mother, which is, you know, would be great, would be amazing, but I always thought that there was more for me. And, you know, when I went to Cornell, I thought, you know, I'm not going to be in the restaurant business anymore. I'm going to be in the hotel business. I'd convinced myself that was the path for me. And, you know, obviously I had a great experience at the hotel school and met some wonderful people there. And when I graduated, I went to work for Marriott because, you know, revenue management was the big thing. People were doing pricing strategy. It was, you know, Expedia was just exploding. And there were all these kind of sexy hotel jobs. And, you know, I worked there for a few years. Culturally, I was, you know, wasn't really the place for me.
And why is that? Like, why wasn't it culturally? Like, what is the difference between?
You know, it lacked, I think, some of the sexiness of the restaurant industry, some of the passion. It was a big company, and I just didn't resonate with the brand. And that's always been so important for me. Like, I want to be able to say, like I do with Tender Greens, when I speak at a conference or speak with you, and you know, I'm representing Tender Greens. I'm so proud of that. It's an honor and a privilege to be in my role, and I feel so lucky. And I think that's so important to keeping me motivated and growing in my position and in my career, is that, you know, I resonate with the brands that I represent. And that just wasn't the case for me with Marriott. And, you know, after some soul searching, I thought, God, why am I fighting this? Like, I grew up in the restaurant business. I know nothing as well as I know restaurants. I mean, I know every angle of restaurant operations. I was never a server, but I'm a great bus girl. And I was lucky enough to get a job when I lived in San Francisco for Vine Solutions. There's a restaurateur, Ed Levine, who had several restaurants left bank. They were called, I think there was five or six, and I called up his HR woman, cold called. I said, hey, I'd really like to work for you guys. Do you have a job for me? And she said, no, there's only a few people in our corporate office, but, you know, we have this company, Vine Solutions, that does basically accounting and consulting work for restaurants, and we're looking for someone who can be, you know, my title is, you know, finance and operations consultant. And I was like, that's perfect. Like, I know operations, I know finance, like, sign me up. And, you know, Ed and I sat with John Priest at the Left Bank in Corte Madera, and they pretty much hired me on the spot. And I was so lucky to work there for 5 years. I got to work with, gosh, like 50 different restaurant concepts in my time there. So I would come in and I would meet with each client every month. We'd review their financials. We'd set strategic goals, operational goals to hit that would help them hit those financial goals. And it was actually probably one of my greatest jobs ever, because I could never in a career have experienced so many operations, been exposed to so many different operators, you know, multi-unit, independent, high-end, I mean, across the board. And it was pretty awesome.
So that was sort of like your PhD after the master's, because you,
yes.
In seeing so many different organizations really up close, I guess at the end of the day, you can advise them and pick what model seems to work for you. But I'm curious about one thing. So your mom was a bookkeeper, and you ended up on the finance side. And, you know, lots of people, when they talk about the restaurants being sexy, which you do, generally people think the chef part is pretty sexy because you're, you know, forward facing. But you chose finance. Was it hard to choose finance? Did it choose you? How did you end up in sort of accounting operations?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I've always been a mathematical numbers person. I mean, I was a little Russian kid. My extracurricular activity was like a math tutor on Sunday, not because I needed help, but because my parents wanted to accelerate my math skills.
Oh, my goodness.
And I thought that was just, you know, all of my Russian friends did that. We were all math kids. That was just like part of the culture. I don't know. And it was so practical, I think. You know, as a self-proclaimed perfectionist, I think, you know, when it's mathematical or operations, there's a right or a wrong. You know, I think I never viewed myself as a creative person, which is something I'm trying to figure out right now, because perhaps I'm more creative than I give myself credit for. But I think it's easier when you think, you know, I'm not a creative person, but I know I can get it right if I do it this way. And I like to get things right. So.
Don't we all? I mean, I think that one of the things about, you know, growing up sort of as a human is realizing that though math may be right and wrong, like in life, there aren't necessarily rights and wrongs. So, and I think that your role now as CFO is actually a pretty creative role. Can you tell me what is it that you do as Chief Financial Officer?
Do I? Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not a traditional CFO. I don't have a CPA. I mean, I know accounting. It came naturally to me, but I'm by no means, you know, the best accountant out there, and I own that. I've always tried to kind of weave finance through everything in the operation, and I think that's what's made me pretty effective in my job, because right now, you know, I work closely with supply chain, I work closely with real estate, work closely with the development team, I work closely with operations. So I try to kind of get involved in everything, and sometimes that's great for people, sometimes that's not. But I truly love operations, and unfortunately, you know, it's not all unicorns and rainbows, and it's not all glamorous and sexy, and you know, we're running a business, and so trying to teach people how finance and you know, financial performance weaves through everything has been a passion of mine. And I, you know, started, you know, just to go back a little, you know, Tender Greens was a client of mine, and you know, in the early days when I was working with them on a consulting basis, a lot of what I did was just teaching everybody financial literacy, teaching everybody how, you know, their actions as a chef impacted the financial performance. And, you know, people don't really want to think about that. And
I'm actually fascinated by that.
You know, and sometimes chefs don't care. I used to work with chefs where I'd say, listen, your food cost is like 37%. And they'd be like, yep, that's cool. I'm like, but, you know, you spent all this money building this restaurant. Until you pay that back, you're not actually making any money. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, I want this menu and I want this special design. And, you know, nobody wants to think about the harsh reality that you do take investor money and you do have to pay it back. You know, and it's people don't really want to think about that part. But I think I was able to simplify the terminology of finance in a way that resonated with chefs and restaurateurs and made them more comfortable with the numbers.
So I think financial literacy is so hugely important. I mean, for every single one of us, you got to bring it to the chef community. But as women, it can be challenging financial literacy, you know, for everyone. And I'm just wondering, what was the key to teaching the chefs? Like, what are the very, very basics that people need to sort of know? Like, chefs or anyone who's thinking about their financial life, like, where do you even begin?
I mean, I guess it depends on what they're thinking about. If they're thinking about, you know, opening a restaurant, or, you know, their own personal, you know, financial position, you know, it's hard for me to say, like, where do you begin, because it's always come naturally to me. So the way that I approach it is I'll sit down and say, like, where are we struggling? Here are the results. The first step is really, you know, seeing the full picture as it is, like, all honest, like, no BS. The financials have to be accurate and say, okay, here's where we really are. What do we want to tackle? If, you know, if food cost is your issue, okay, well, there's a lot of areas where that might be that we could address that could help that. Are you ordering too much? You know, I always have this theory, and this kind of actually came from Ed Levine. You know, if you have three cases of avocados and one falls on the floor and rolls under – on the floor and you're like, ah, I'm too busy, I'm not going to grab it, you're like, okay, fine. But if you have one case and you know it has to last you through the shift, you're going to be more mindful. You're going to say, oh, I don't want to lose that avocado because I need it. And it can be little things like that. And so that's kind of how I started, is like very like baby steps. Let's think of small strategies that don't mean like change your menu. It doesn't mean change, you know, the product integrity. Like, how can we do little things to actually, you know, secure our financial position? And people like that, because no chef wants to be told, you know, well, you can't use, you know, those truffles, or, you know, you just spent a whole season coming up with your fall menu and, you know, it's too expensive, so you can't have it. So let's be creative in how we can, you know, meet our financial goals without compromising the menu. And, you know, working with Eric at Tender Greens, I mean, we put so much emphasis on product integrity. That's just one area where it's non-negotiable. You know, I joke, you know, one year Eric was like, we're going to use heirloom tomatoes for the whole season, for the whole company. And I tell him how much that's going to cost, thinking he's going to say, okay, we're not going to do it. And he's like, okay, understood. We'll figure it out somewhere else. And we did. So it depends what's most important to, you know, the restaurateur or the chef. And, you know, you can't have it all. I think that's an unfortunate reality that people don't always want to face. And you have to make some sacrifices. It's just a matter of figuring out which are the right ones.
So if I was going to extrapolate to the real world beyond chefs, right, and you're trying to run your own life, you're basically saying take a really hard look at the entire picture and where you're letting something roll, whether it's an avocado or, you know, a haircut, like where you're like, oh, it's okay, it doesn't matter, and know that every single decision you make matters so that you can make sure that the overall equation works. Like, you just have to compromise within a whole. And I think a lot of people don't step back to see the bigger picture and to realize that they don't have to deny themselves. They just have to make trade-offs. It's sort of the same thing in dieting, you know, like you don't have to stop eating. You should just maybe eat less of something. In this case, spend maybe a little bit less money. We're going to take a quick break here. And after this commercial, we're going to be back with Speaking Broadly, Lena O'Connor, who is telling us about the role of chief financial officer at an incredible restaurant group. Stay with us.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market believes in seeking out local, fresh, and seasonal food, and in supporting local farmers, makers, and the community as a whole, economically and agriculturally. Whole Foods Market believes in food that is vivid and colorful, fresh and full of nutrients. Food that connects you to your body, the seasons, and to nature. Food that helps you do more, sleep better, and wake up happier. Found in over 400 locations throughout the United States, Whole Foods Market only sells food that meets their standards, which means no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, ever. Whole Foods Market believes in real food. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and welcome back to Speaking Broadly. Today, my guest is Lena O'Connor. Lena, I can't wait to hear about the deal that you helped negotiate between Tender Greens and Union Square Hospitality Group, because that was a big deal, getting investment from Danny Meyer. And, you know, in all the press releases, you get the credit for that. What was that like?
It was pretty amazing. I think, you know, we were very lucky to meet Danny and it and also Josh Golden from ACG, and it felt like family. They have a similar culture, they have a similar emphasis on quality. So it was pretty surreal, to be honest. I mean, sitting in a room with Danny, you're like, oh my God, it's like the godfather of hospitality. And, you know, he's sitting here and he's interested in us. And it was an exciting time, I think, for everybody. And, you know, the deal, I mean, I think just like any deal, it's an exorbitant amount of work, but it was done in such a thoughtful way. It wasn't ever contentious. Everybody really wanted to get it done. We wanted to work together, and I think that you know, made all the work and effort fun. But you know, it was you know, a very I mean, for 9 months, me and David Dressler, our one of our founders, I mean, we were holed up in what we call our think tank, and we were working on this deal, you know, 24/7, and it was so fun. I mean, I was so excited to make this deal happen. And I remember, you know, you said you would talk about it. I remember the day it closed. It was like I literally like burst out into tears in David's office. I was like, oh my God, we did it. I mean, we'd been working on it for so long, and you know, it's been so incredible even since we closed the deal to have, you know, Danny and Josh and Jeff and our whole board and their perspective. And I think we just feel so lucky that the timing aligned, that, you know, they were interested in making an investment, we were interested in finding investors. And it was, I think, you know, sometimes the stars align, and they did for us at that point.
Well, let's talk about tears, because you burst into tears of joy. And I know that, you know, that sometimes life can get very overwhelming, and there are other kinds of tears. Do you find that there's just a massive amount of work and it can get to you emotionally, or... what about those tears?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a little. I'm an open book. I tend to, repress my feelings because I don't have time for them. But if I'm being perfectly honest, most of the time I'm like, I don't have time to deal with this anger or sadness or disappointment because there's too much to do. And then eventually it catches up to you, whether it's tears of joy or frustration or whatnot. And they tend to creep up on me in unexpected times. And that's, you know, something I'm working on. We all have the opportunity for improvement. And I think, you know, I could probably do a better job acknowledging the feelings when they come and dealing with them. But yeah, it's, you know, when you're so busy and when there's so much going on, it's hard to make space for that.
Well, I think it's hard because you have two brilliant children and a husband. And so there's an enormous number of claims on your time. You know, do you believe that your life is in balance, or... do not spend time thinking about that, because that would be...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's life is in balance. I think we're always off balance in one way or the other, and sometimes I'm giving too much to my job and not enough to my family, and sometimes I'm giving too much to my family and not enough to maybe my parents or my friends. And, you know, I think, you know, I'm always trying to reprioritize, and I think what I've learned over the years is, you know, we have a limited amount of time here. Let's spend our time in thoughtful ways, in ways that are meaningful to us. Let's spend our time with people that bring us joy, and be better about saying no. And, you know, I'm not perfect at it. Sometimes I'll look at my calendar on top of, you know, my job and my wonderful husband and my kids. You know, I have a lot of social commitments. I like to participate in things like this. I like to speak at conferences. And I'll look at my calendar. I'm like, man, I have 5 events in 1 week and 5 night events. And I'm like, God, that's not good for my kids. It's not good for my family. I shouldn't have said yes to all of them. But I want to do all of them. So it's always a little bit of, you know, push and pull, and trying to not feel guilty for, you know, missing the event or missing bedtime. Right. I mean, it's there's no perfect formula.
I mean, I've had that struggle myself. I always felt like at Food and Wine, I always could do more, and at home I could always be there more. And I felt like that was probably, you know, for me, that was how the universe stayed in balance, that both were cheated. You know, if if one felt like it wasn't cheated at all, then I was probably hurting the other. So having work and home in some sort of both slightly deprived seemed to me to be like the best I could hope for, and also showed that I just had, you know, an ambition to do the most possible, which it sounds like you're going as you're, I think, frankly, you're going much harder than I am. 5 things in a week. That's a lot. I know you do lots of travel as well. You've talked a little bit about personal growth and change, and you're up for an open to that. I know that you had a bat mitzvah recently, and you're not 13. So I'm
a multiple of 13. So I turned 39 this year. So I figured it would be appropriate to have a bat mitzvah.
You picked a good year. But what motivated that? Because I think that's unusual and really wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm wired to pursue personal growth, really growth in all areas, and I enjoy challenging myself, and I was at a point where I felt like, you know, despite everything on my plate, everything was familiar, and I really wanted to find something that I could go deeper. I've always been kind of searching for, like, depth, right? I mean, I'm doing a lot of things, but I wanted to go deeper, and, you know, my kids went to Jewish nursery school and to Sunday school, and, you know, I did not grow up, you know, particularly religious. We were somewhat observant, but it was a complicated relationship with Judaism because, you know, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. My parents lived in communist Russia where religion was completely repressed, so they could not be practicing Jews. And so when we moved to the United States, it just wasn't a priority for my family. You know, and then as I had kids and I was trying to give them a Jewish education, I realized, you know, hey, my kids are more involved in this than I am. And I felt kind of like a fraud. I was like, I was sitting there at services, you know, the two times a year you go to services for the high holidays. And I'm like, I don't know any of the prayers. I don't know any of the songs. Like, you know, if I'm going to do this, I need to be authentic. Like, it can't be BS. I can't be just pretending to be a Jew. I need to understand more about the history of our people and where we came from. And actually, my good friend Dana Kibler, who's also a female CFO, there's not a lot of us, she reached out to me. She said, hey, there's this B'nai Mitzvah class. Should we do it together? And I jumped at it. I'm like, this. I didn't know that was what I was looking for, but when it came up, I was like, this is it. This is exactly what I need. And it was a big commitment. I mean, we studied for, gosh, 7 months. I taught myself to read Hebrew.
Wow.
I ultimately chanted from the Torah without vowels. I mean, it was like this crazy out-of-body experience, and I was more proud of myself for doing that than many of the other things that I've achieved, because it was so hard, you know, as an adult to learn this complicated language, to you know, dedicate the time. But it was when I was learning Hebrew on the weekends, I was so happy because, like, I had to work so hard to learn it that I had to turn my brain off from everything else. Like, I could not think about anything else, but I had to be so focused to learn this, like, crazy language.
It sounds like that's actually like a form of meditation.
I enjoyed that outlet, that opportunity, that permission to focus on something that's just for me.
It does sound like a form of meditation, really. I mean, the goal in meditation is to, you know, be able to focus completely, and it seems like that just shut the world out for you. Did you find that it connected you or made you more curious about the Holocaust survivors' stories or your parents' own stories? It's interesting to me that they came to the States and, you know, religion became de-emphasized, because, of course, it would also be possible to have the reverse occur. So,
I mean, listen, it's complicated. They came here. They had $300 in their pocket. They didn't speak the language. They had, you know, my mom's brother was here, and that was it. So I think it was also just out of necessity. They had to learn English. They had to find jobs. I mean, it was so, looking back, I mean, how brave of them to leave everything behind and just, like, show up here and, you know, given all, let's not go into what's going on in this country about immigration. But, yeah, I mean, it definitely made me more curious. My grandparents didn't talk a lot about the Holocaust. It's always been kind of painful for me, and you know, my grandparents have now passed away, and I regret not learning more. I think everybody regrets something like that when their grandparents go. It was always just so painful that I chose to look away instead of learn more about it. And, you know, I am curious, and I, you know, part of my studies weren't just, you know, learning to read Hebrew, but we did Torah study. We, you know, read books about Jewish history, and it's pretty, I mean, yeah, it's disappointing and sad and hurtful. And I just, yeah, I probably am still suppressing my emotions about it, if I'm being honest.
Is there something from doing the Torah study and having this sort of very personal and empowering experience that, in fact, you translated back to the work that you do? Like, did it change your life in some meaningful way, or do you feel like you just picked up and, you know, kept going? It's something that you internalized and moved ahead.
No, it definitely, you know, when I finished my my bat mitzvah, I decide I'm going to continue to focus on Jewish studies. This just can't just be it. So I'm going to go to a monthly Torah study class, which I'm happy about. But then it made me think, you know, what other things are out there that would make me happy? And, you know, we spoke a little bit about this in D.C. is, you know, I've been so busy doing so many things. You know, do all of them make me happy, or am I doing them just because I should be, because they're cool, because it's such a great opportunity, you know, and I'm trying to find that next, you know, I don't want to say commitment activity, something that's actually going to bring me the most amount of joy, and that's kind of my headspace after my bat mitzvah is like, let me spend my time doing things that bring me joy, spend my time with people that bring me joy, and, you know, be better about saying no to things that don't serve me or my family, and it's easier said than done, but I'm working on it. I'm always a work in progress.
I think one of the things that really strikes me is that after having had this experience of going deeper, which was very satisfying, you're looking for another, it's like skipping stones. You know, you want to go to what the next skip is. You want to go deeper so that you're life continues to have a deeper meaning. I can just imagine it's like a layer cake. You know, you put down this foundation of the bat mitzvah and then you find the next thing and let's call it, you know, salsa dancing. And then you have that and like you just become a richer, more amazing cake by the end of it.
That's a great analogy. Yeah. I mean, I want to layer on the flavors. I want to, I want to do interesting things, and, you know, I still might do it. I wanted to do Krav Maga, because I thought that would, you know, I want to be able to, like, defend myself, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, we'll see where it goes. It's a matter of really, like, carving out the time and dedicating yourself to it, and I was able to do that with my Hebrew study, and I enjoyed it so much, and it wasn't work, so I'm trying to find that next thing that's not going to feel like an obligation, but just a pleasure. Right. And I mean, one of those things, you know, we talked about this with our mutual friend Ellen is, you know, supporting up and coming entrepreneurs and, you know, young restaurateurs who are trying to figure out how to make it. And, you know, lots of people call me for advice and, you know, I pretty much take anyone's call who's asking for help because I so enjoy, you know, helping people. That really, we talked about this a little, that really brings me a lot of pleasure to help others, and I'd like to do more of that.
So, on that note, there aren't a lot of women CFOs, as you mentioned. For someone who wants to follow the path that you've taken, what's the best way to go about that? Like, what's your advice to people who they love the restaurant business, or they love whatever, you know, they love another area, but they really want to go up the finance side. Like, is that an easy thing to do, or are there obvious stepping stones?
I want to say it's really not linear, right? I mean, the CFO role is, you know, is so different in every company and every CFO. You can come up through accounting, you can come up through finance, you can come up through operations. There's so many different ways. And I would say at the end of the day, if that's something that you want to do, you know, call me or find somebody, you know, that's a role model or a mentor and, you know, let's plan it out. Let's, you know, set your sights on it. When I first came to Tender Greens, I wasn't the CFO, I was the director of finance, and I was like, I want to be the CFO. Like, and I came to Dave and Eric and Matt at the time, and I was like, guys, I want to be the CFO. And I put it out there, and I kept talking about it, and, you know, what do I need to do to get there? What skill sets do I need to build? And actually putting in the work. You can't just want to do it without putting in the work. That it doesn't work out that way. It's not reality. But you also can't put in the work without putting it out in the universe. Let's say you can't put in the work and not, you know, communicate to your boss or whoever you're working with it that that's what you're aiming for. And I think women have a tendency to put in the work without telling people what they want to achieve. And I think when you put those two together, you put in the work and you vocalize what your goals are, that's the magic.
I think that is fantastic advice and something that just has been a big topic of conversation is, what can we do to support, or what can women who've achieved some success do to support other women coming up? Because we need more women entrepreneurs. We need more women in positions of power. And I think that advice of, you know, doing the work, vocalizing it, making it clear, and just having that that target and not being shy about it is critically important. Each episode of Speaking Broadly, we conclude with nominating a woman to the Hall of Dames. So is there a woman with whom you've worked or who you admire, who you would nominate? They need to be in the food world and ideally living.
I mean, hands down, no question. It would have to be my mother, Bella Linsman.
And why?
I mean, you know, she's been in this business now, gosh, almost 35 years.
And what's your mom's name, by the way?
She does such an amazing job in making people feel good. I mean, you should see the emails, notes, comments she gets from people when she goes to their homes and throws a party for them. Or, you know, she's created this environment. I mean, it's not easy to keep a restaurant open for 35 years. But people keep coming back because they're connected to her. And, you know, connecting to so many people is not easy. Not everybody has that gift. And I think that's something that I've learned from her and from my experience there is, like, at the end of the day, we're all just people. And the way that we're successful is we learn to connect with others. And that's a tricky thing in this day and age where everybody's glued to their phones and it's easier to email or text and pick up the phone and talk to somebody. But, you know, making that human connection, I think, is part of her success, and I think is important to everybody's success in the future, even though I love my iPhone and it's really important to me. We still have to speak to one another.
And so what do you think her secret of connecting is?
I think she listens to people. I think she's kind of like a mediator, diffuser. Like, she can make any tense situation into a calm one. And I think that's what I learned from my 2 years, you know, running the floor at Chinois when it was crazy and busy and we'd, you know, do three turns and serve, you know, 200 covers and, you know, people would come in angry. They had to wait too long. And then by the time they're leaving, they're giving me a hug and saying thank you. And, you know, it's how that you recover from a situation that people remember. They forget that they were angry. And it's that recovery and making people feel heard and taken care of that resonates with them.
Well, I think that's a beautiful way to end this episode of Speaking Broadly. Lena, thank you so much. If people want to reach out to you or follow you on social, how do they do that?
You know, I'm not a big social media person, but I do have an Instagram. It's just at Lena O'Connor. That's it. Really, really creative. Or you can reach out to me via email. Really easy. Just lena@tendergreens.com.
That's totally simple. And this is Dana Cowan. You can find me at FW Scout. I love hearing your feedback, things you like, things you want to hear more about, people you want to recommend to have on the show. All really great. I want to thank my engineer, David Tatasciore, for an awesome day, and my in-studio lurker, Carlin. And have a great week, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.